The train continued south, the rhythm of its wheels regular, gentle, and soporific. Lyon came and went, and the countryside changed from the spring-green curves of Burgundy to the more jagged scenery of the Midi, with vineyards clinging to steep hillsides and a perceptibly deeper blueness in the sky. While Cyrus snored softly, André told Lucy what he knew about Provence. A different country, with its own language and its own impenetrable way of speaking French. The personality of the people, hot and quick-tempered and Mediterranean. The perception of time, marked by seasons instead of clocks, with punctuality dismissed as a curious northern obsession. The empty beauty of the backcountry, the crowded good humor of markets, and the food. The tapenade and estouffade, truffles and figs, goat's cheeses, olive oil, herb-flavored lamb from Sisteron, the diamond-shaped calisson of Aix.
Stomach growling? You're not alone. That's author Peter Mayle reading from his newest book, Chasing Cézanne. The world first enjoyed Mayle's luscious description of French food, French culture, and the French countryside in his first book, A Year in Provence. It was an instant success, appearing on the New York Times bestseller list for 3 years. Now, with subsequent books like Toujours Provence and Hotel Pastis, his name is nearly synonymous with the south of France, and his familiarity with the region is so intimate, the reader often wonders if he discovered the place. Peter Mayle actually began his professional life as an advertising executive in New York City. But in the mid-70s, after 15 years of the grind, he gave up the glamour and fast pace of Manhattan and moved with his wife Jenny to Provence in the south of France. He joins us today for a special Places of the Heart to talk about the country that captured his imagination and inspires his best-selling books. Peter, what drew you to the south of France in the first place?
I think the fact that I was English had a lot to do with it.
You're tired of rain?
Me? No, you live under a sort of permanent gray cloud there. And I remember being very shocked in a nice as possible way the first time I ever went to France, which I went to Paris, and I discovered food because I'd grown up after the war and I'd gone to my education, been at an English boarding school where you ate mysterious things that were grey in colour and had no taste at all. And that's what I thought food was. And then I went to Paris when I think I was 17 and somebody took me to a proper restaurant. I thought, my God, people actually live like this all the time. So that was sort of partly the sort of lure of the stomach, and also the fact that I happen to like the French, which I know is not a fashionable attitude to have, but I like their priorities, particularly the country French, the rural French. I like the language very much. I love the countryside. And in Provence, you have the bonus of a very, very pleasant climate, wonderful light, and the Mediterranean on the doorstep.
What are the priorities of those French country folks?
They tend to move at a different rhythm to the rest of the world, it seems to me, because their livelihood is locked into the land with agriculture and vines and wine and stuff like that. And so they never seem to be unduly hurried to go anywhere or do anything, which can be very exasperating. As a businessman, I'm sure it would have driven me mad, but as a resident, it is just delightful because people take their time. They have a tremendous respect for the table and their stomachs. Everything shuts down from 12 to 2 or 3 o'clock in Provence every day because people are eating lunch. And I find that extremely attractive, and I think it's also rather healthy and good for you.
When you first moved to Provence, were the locals happy to have you there? And how do they regard you today, the second part of that question?
They've always been very pleasant to me. I mean, when Jenny and I first went there as residents rather than as holiday makers, we had some fairly sketchy French. I mean, we weren't fluent by any manner of means. And they were very sympathetic to us, and they were pleased, I think, that we had chosen to come and live in their part of the world rather than being born there or having to live there by dint of business pressure.
But then you've written these books that have created this enormous interest in their neighborhood. Is there any resentment of that?
Well, I think there probably is, because nobody's universally loved. I haven't run into it personally, except in one or two occasions, and the people who really are frightfully annoyed with me are the English, the expatriate English, people who live there, who, in that fine old colonial spirit, think that they discovered it and it's theirs, and how dare anybody else come. And they accused me of encouraging people to come and visit it. And I said, well, why not? It's not, you know, the French actually rather like people visiting. They are extremely happy to have tourism because agriculture is becoming more and more of a difficult way to earn a living.
How has Provence changed since you moved there in the 70s?
Extraordinarily little, very little indeed.
Which is just fine with you.
Yeah, and I think all these, that's what makes me sort of irritated when people accuse me of having ruined it by encouraging so many tourists down there. There's actually nowhere for them to sleep. The place doesn't have very many hotels. It's a spread out area, which is mainly vines or mountains or forests with little villages. There aren't any golf courses, there aren't any theme parks, there are no huge hotels, there are no condominiums. People who come to Provence usually come for the same reasons that I went there, which is they want peace, quiet, beautiful scenery and a decent meal at the end of the day. And those aren't the sort of people who ruin countries.
What do Americans find most surprising in their first visit to the south of France?
I think the amount of food that people, that the French eat, and why they're not all fat. That's the thing that seems to, as a recurring question that I get asked anyway. They say, well, how could you possibly eat that four-course lunch and a four-course dinner and not be the size of a house? And it's true that you don't really see very many cases of obesity in France, but I suspect that's got much more to do with what goes into the ingredients, because I think in America probably ingredients are subject to much higher levels of artificial treatment. Also, I think Americans tend to eat a lot between meals, whereas French don't. And in America, you know, it's one of the things that you notice so much coming over from France is that in cars and on the street, people are eating and drinking all the time. And you don't see that in France at all.
Your latest book, your latest novel, is called Chasing Cézanne, and it has a thing or two to do with glamour. Other than that, how's it different from your previous books?
What is different about it is that part of it takes place in New York, and then it goes to Paris and down to Provence, and with a brief stop in England. I got very interested in art when I read an article in the Chicago Tribune, which said that the amount, value of missing and stolen art in the world today has just exceeded $3 billion, and nobody knows where it all is. And I thought, well, that's very interesting. And then from there on, I've always had a sort of vague interest and sympathy for non-violent crime. And I thought, well, if I were a criminal and I wanted to steal, you know, a $30 or $40 million painting, how would I go about doing it? And that's the way the book came about. And because such a very, very important part of the art business in general is conducted in New York, it seemed to be you know, an obvious place to include in the story.
Would you read us a passage that is actually set on Cap Ferrat, that spit of land in the south of France, which you describe that section of the country?
Sure. I mean, it's actually one of the sort of last outposts of calm and seclusion on the Riviera. And here we go. Cap Ferrat, elegantly wooded with palm and pine trees, impeccably maintained, furiously expensive, has long been one of the most fashionable addresses on the Côte d'Azur. It juts into the Mediterranean to the east of Nice, villas of the famous and notorious, screened by high walls and thick hedges, guarded by iron gates, insulated from the common herd by a buffer of money. Past residents include King Leopold II of Belgium, Somerset Maugham, and the coiffure-conscious Baroness Beatrice de Rothschild, who never, ever ventured abroad without a trunk containing 50 wigs. Most of the current residents in these more democratic and dangerous times prefer to be unlisted, unknown, and undisturbed. And Cap Ferrat is one of the few places along the coast where they are able to avoid the jostle and clamor of tourism. Indeed, one of the first things the visitor coming from Nice notices is the absence of hubbub. A sense of calm prevails. People who live here, one feels, never have to rush.
Which is exactly what you like about the south of France, isn't it? Never having
to rush. That's it. I don't think I could anymore. My doctors advised me not to.
Peter Mayle's new novel is called Chasing Cézanne. It's published by Knopf.